This November, California voters will have their say on several ballot propositions and initiatives. What are the implications for California? We'll ask John Myers with the LA Times and Laurel Rosenhall with CalMatters.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome, I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. Well, the November ballot's going to be asking Californians to weigh in on a number of public policy issues. We're fortunate to have two well-respected observers of state politics to explain the what and the why behind the November's propositions. We have Laurel Rosenhall, the covers capital California politics for Cal Matters, and John Myers, the Sacramento Bureau Chief with the LA Times. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Laurel, sorry for mangling that there in the beginning, I apologize. Affordable housing, big issue in California. Number of props on the state ballot. For example, we've got Prop 1, a $4 billion bond for affordable housing. We've got the Prop 2, the $2 billion initiative for permanent housing aimed at the chronically homeless and the mentally ill. Are either one of these a game changer?
Not a game changer, but a major infusion of, you know, one-time cash. So they would help a lot in terms of building new housing, but it's not going to...
The need is huge.
I was just going to say, it's not going to take care of the entire need.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, consider one of the numbers out of this, Mark. In a lot of years, the state roughly builds about 100,000 new homes. It needs to build double that number. And the bond measures that we're sitting here talking about, they're certainly helpful for veterans. They're helpful for lower income Californians. They don't help middle class Californians. And they don't help, I think, the systemic problems that you see in Southern California and the Bay Area. It's not enough. I mean, everybody's going to say something is better than nothing. The question is, what else could we do? Should we be doing?
Yeah, kind of driving the bucket. I was looking at the numbers, and they're saying that the backlog by 2025, we need to build 1.8 million homes to cover the backlog. And if you want to satisfy demand, lower prices, you got to add another 1.7 million. So we're talking, I'm not sure my math is right, 3.5 million new homes by 2025. That's a lot of new homes.
Well, and not only that, but you look at any given year, you just haven't done what you need in the year, and then you look at what the candidates for governor, like I'm reminded of numbers that were like 300,000, 500,000 a year. That hasn't been done in any year in modern California history.
You know, in 2012, John, Governor Brown nixed these things called local redevelopment agencies, RDAs, and about $1 billion of that money, he was trying to save because of the budget constraints, of RDA funds was going to affordable housing. Is Prop 1 and 2, are they an attempt to kind of get back to that?
I don't think so. One, because they're limited. They're veterans, low-income Californians. The money probably won't get distributed statewide in the way redevelopment agencies existed. And then keep in mind, too, redevelopment agencies went away in part because they had a lousy track record in a lot of places for actually building housing versus using money for other things. In some instances, only about a fifth of the money actually went to housing versus development.
Well, there were some anecdotes that were just really problematic. What do you think, if we see these props fail, are we going to see another attempt to create a kind of an RDA 2.0?
I think you're going to see that either way. Okay. Assemblyman David Chu has already said that he plans to bring it back, and the only stumbling block for him has been Jerry Brown, who doesn't want to do it. So next year with a new governor, I absolutely expect that'll come back.
Yeah, I want to jump over to Prop 10, which is a law that repeals restrictions on cities and counties from enacting rent control measures. Are the arguments that it's going to save or devastate the housing market really overstated? What do you think, Laurel?
I think that there's a lot of hyperbole in all of these propositions, mm-hmm. and that one, you know, included. You know, it is, there's a lot of studies that show that the impacts of rent control are very hurtful on the, you know, local housing markets. At the same time, there are persuasive arguments from people who are in cities without rent control, who are seeing their rents go up and up and up, mm-hmm. and who are really begging for some kind of relief.
What do you think, John?
I think the hardest part about Prop 10 is that it is simply releasing the restrictions on rent control. It doesn't mandate rent control will happen. It doesn't change anything guaranteed in any community in California. And there are these economic push points about that people will no longer rent these places if they are limited on what they can make on it. Mm-hmm. But I think to Laurel's point exactly, people say lots of things in campaigns. This would be one step, but it's a small step and it's not a guaranteed step. And lawmakers in Sacramento ultimately have to come up with a
That's a really important point. It's a local control issue. Eventually, if it does past. Let me ask you one last question, John. CEQA, you know, the California Environmental Quality Act, a lot of people, certainly Republicans, point to that law as really hurting the ability to build more housing. You think there's going to be an attempt, regardless of what happens on these propositions, to amend CEQA?
It's been talked about a lot. Governor Brown, who of course will be leaving office shortly, has said there was never a CEQA exemption that he didn't like. But doing it is a tricky thing, and the reason it hasn't been done, I think, in part, is because there are environmentalists who believe you don't throw all of this out. You don't completely gut this law that actually makes people take a second look at the environmental impact of things. I think that CEQA is a ballot measure waiting to happen. The question is there money behind construction groups, business groups to move it forward or not? I don't know, but it's got to go to the ballot.
There's a prediction for 2020. Well, up next, a water prop is on tap. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Laurel Rosenhall with Cal Matters and John Myers with the LA Times. Water is one of those perennial California public policy issues. We're at it again, Laurel. So Prop 3, the Water Supply and Quality Act of 2018, would authorize about $9 billion in bonds for a wide variety of specifically detailed water projects. Given that it follows Prop 1 and 2, are voters going to have bond fatigue when they hit Prop 3?
I would say it's possible, but not likely. Generally, the pattern has been that voters approve bonds and are okay with borrowing money if they like the purpose. On the other hand, you know, we did just have a water bond a few months ago on the June ballot, and so depending on how tuned in they are, you know, that may be a factor.
What do you think?
I don't know. I think if there's ever a test to see if voters won't support a bond measure, it could be Prop 3. It could be simply because of the points that Laurel just stated. Also, too, you look at the ballot analysis. We're talking about something that will cost over time $17 billion, about $8 billion in bonds, but $17 billion to pay it all off with interest. They were very smart, the backers of Prop 3, in getting a lot of buy-in from a lot of groups, ag and environmentalists and conservation people. There is no formal opposition to Prop 3.
But this follows other water bonds. You know, we had a water bond in June,
right?
And we had one in 2014. The one in June was $4 billion. The one in 14 was $7.5 billion.
And the proponent of Prop 3 has even said that this is almost like where the 2014 measure that Governor Brown supported, Prop 1, left off, that it's that kind of projects. I think people will say that the water supply is important in California, that the mechanics, the needs are real. Whether this is the right one remains to be seen, but voters do not have problems with bonds, to Laurel's point. They just say, hey, that's fine, let's do it.
Let's fill the reservoir, which Laurel aims me to my next question, that is on water supply. It's in the title, the Water Supply and Quality Act of 2018, but only about $2 billion, less than a quarter of the money, actually goes to increasing the supply of water. Despite that, Prop 3 has the backing of agribusiness. Why is ag accepting not even half, but really a quarter of a loaf?
Because $2 billion is $2 billion more than zero. Okay. I mean, honestly, I just think that, you know, in order to get something that was going to be politically viable, they needed that broad coalition that John described. You know, you need to have environmentalists on board. It can't be an ag-only deal. And so everyone kind of who's supporting it is getting some of the projects that they think are best for the state.
And so does this mean the water wars are solved?
No, I don't think, no, of course not. We wouldn't be that crazy to say this. But let's not forget, to your point about agribusiness, Mark, everybody wins if California has more water. And like, look at Prop 3. It has water conservation, ways to, you know, to make sure that we're not wasting water, you know, recycling issues. I mean, so my point is, it doesn't change the system of water, but if there's more water in existing rules, if you're the agribusiness community, maybe you think that's a pretty good deal, that therefore, you know, it helps you in the long run.
Well, some of the opponents, John, saying that this is really a pay-to-play situation, that some special interests are receiving special funding guarantees. They specifically point to the $750 million of the $1.2 billion to repair canals going to a specific canal, the 152-mile Kern-Fryant Canal in the Valley. Proponents, though, on the other side would say, listen, water's vital to California's infrastructure. It's vital to ag that feeds the nation. They also argue that the reason why we're in this predicament is because of government regulations, lack of surface storage being built that caused the overdraft in groundwater, and that caused subsidence. What do you think the voters are going to think?
I don't know. It depends on whether the voters dig down that deep, I guess, is the question. But, you know, the idea that there are special carve-outs and exemptions for people. That's true, but they're the people who backed it. They're the people who gathered the signatures. They're the people who put up the money to do it, and that is the direct democracy system in California. I would also point out that one of the reasons people do that is because initiatives are a lot harder to change than measures that are put on the ballot by the legislature. They can go back in and tinker their public hearings. You get pretty much what you want if you go raise $3 million and gather signatures and get it on the ballot.
Well, let me ask you, Laurel, kind of going to that point. The Prop 3 opponents would argue that unlike the June water bond, this water bond was not vetted by the legislature, but rather kind of crafted in secret. Do they have a point, or is this a distinction really without a difference? I mean, lobbying and that kind of stuff happens with legislation too.
Sure.
Backroom deals.
I would say it's a distinction with a small difference. You know, there are lobbyists who work the Capitol and make backroom deals with the legislators. There's no surprise about that. On the other hand, the process in the legislature is going to allow for those who are engaged to, you know, have the means to be represented in the state capitol to kind of get the updates along the way and push for little amendments and little tweaks and a few more dollars here and a few less dollars there. And so because there's a little bit more of a process, you know, there is more opportunity to have some input as opposed to something that gets on the ballot. Once it's qualified for the ballot, that's it. Can't be tinkered or changed at all.
And it comes, I know you've done some work on this in this area in terms of lobbying and whatnot in the state legislature. Do you see this as a distinction without a difference?
I think everybody says that when they're not at the table, right? Everyone complains until they get their moment in that. And when you see who these people are, if you're not one of them, you get unhappy. But again, there's very little formal opposition to these bonds, and
right.
We haven't seen campaigns on these bonds. And I would think if you had a concern about it, you would run a campaign in some way to point
right.
that out.
Well, there's no opposition with any money at this point. Well, I mean, Sierra Club is against it and some newspaper editorial boards, but there's no money
right.
campaign.
Well, up next, we're going to talk about one of those contentious propositions. That's Prop 6 on the ballot. Up next, when this discussion, the Maddie Report continues. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. Perhaps no proposition on November ballot has generated more interest than Prop 6, the effort to repeal SB1, the 12-cent gas tax, among other things. Our guests are Laurel Rosenhall with CalMatters and John Myers with the LA Times. So John, although generally characterized as a repeal of the state's new fuel taxes and vehicle fees, there's an important aspect of this proposition that may be being overlooked, and that is it would require voter approval of any future fuel and vehicle-related taxes and fees. What are the implications of that?
Well, the implications simply are that the legislature won't be able to take action in the way it has in the past, and certainly won't be able to do what it did in increasing gas taxes in 2017, which is what this is all about. It really, to me, Mark, it's the sweetener of this, right? I mean, it's the thing, you know, voters love to vote in the state on ballot measures. And any idea
particularly
that
on budget matters.
Right. Well, budgets, taxes, things like that. Mm-hmm. Anytime you tell them you're going to get to have a say at that, that is what I think was designed to try to kind of boost that turnout. The polling hasn't shown it so far. I think they're struggling to get their message out. But I think clearly that was aimed at trying to get a yes vote that much more so.
Is it that ballot box budgeting issue again, Laurel? So what do you think? Pretty important implications if that thing passes?
Yeah, and I think that, cities and local governments are terrified about this idea. And part of the problem is that, you know, this gas tax known as SB1 is really focused on maintaining the roads, really unglamorous kinds of projects, filling potholes, doing kind of some basic maintenance.
And it's a basic government function.
Correct. But if you are now tasked with going to the voters to ask for money, then usually you're going to want to peddle something shiny and new. And how are you going to sell voters on the idea of, you know, we've just got to pave the roads?
Well, let me ask you this. A lot of people seem to acknowledge that this proposition, Prop 6, is really about energizing the Republican base, getting them out to vote, and particularly in those contested congressional races in California. Will it be enough to overcome the Trump factor in California?
That was the goal. I'm not sure it's going to pan out, honestly. The recent polling doesn't look encouraging in competitive districts. Only a little over a third of likely voters said they plan to vote yes on this. Now, there's still another month to go, but the yes campaign doesn't have a huge amount of money, and I'm not sure in the end that'll be a huge game changer.
I think one of the most fascinating things out of this to me is that it's somewhat counterintuitive what you have to do as a voter here, because if you don't like the gas tax, You have to vote yes.
Right.
If you like the gas tax, you have to vote no. And that's not the normal messaging you get in a campaign. It's like, no gas tax, but yes,
vote yes
on Prop 6. So I think that is struggling there too. And honestly, they just don't have the money. I mean, all of the construction industry, the building industry, organized labor, the governor's backers, business groups are all in it for the gas tax to exist as it does. The backers of the repeal have not had money after those congressional candidates put the money in. It's a really tough race.
I think it's going to, there are fractures there in the Republican Party between the business interests who want SB1 to stay in place and the anti-tax groups that want to get rid of it. I mean, isn't that critical?
Absolutely.
I think so. I mean, and the business groups have backed a lot of Republican politics in the past. You wonder if there's an after effect to all
this.
Well,
I think this is part of kind of a bigger evolution we're seeing with business groups in California. You know, they're no longer wedded to the Republican Party. You know, they have put a lot of money into fostering a cohort of moderate Democrats in the state legislature, and they have seen that the way to kind of get their policies across is to convince Democrats. So I don't see, I see this whole dynamic as kind of part of that bigger evolution
for
business.
Let's flip it. What about the Democratic Party? You've got a situation there where typically they don't like regressive taxes mm-hmm. like a sales tax. Why haven't we heard more opposition from, you know, progressives and Democrats, you know, saying, you know, we don't want the gas tax either?
I mean, some people are saying that. It's not that no one's saying it, but generally you have just an enormous broad range of constituencies that want this thing, including, you know, construction unions and many of the trades, that this is going to be a ton of jobs.
I think that's right. And I think also, too, the backlog is real. There have been years and years.
Anybody who drives knows that.
Yeah, the backlog is real. And there really is no other way to do it. There simply hasn't been. You know, the opposition to the gas tax has said, well, you could use money from this pot or that pot or redirect this. But those are really complicated, very hard to do. I think the Democrats in the Capitol knew this was really the only thing to do. And even if they didn't love it, regressive tax is a really good point. They held their nose and went for it. And so we're going to see in November where the voters are.
Let me ask you this. Governor Brown's sitting on $15 million in campaign war chest. We don't know if he's going to run again for something, but let's assume he's not. Is he going to use some of that money to
not
help?
A chance.
Really?
Not a chance. I don't think so. Now, it's a bold prediction, right? I'll see if I'm wrong by the time voters see this show. I don't think he does, because I think that's his seed money to play in politics after he leaves in the end of the year. I don't think Jerry Brown's going away. I think Jerry Brown wants to remain a force. I would also point out to people that on the 2020 ballot, we think we're going to see another fight over his parole changes, which he really cared about in 2016, Prop 57. He could want to come back and campaign to that. They have plenty of money to try to protect the gas tax in this campaign. I don't think Jerry Brown's
going to. You're going to make it unanimous?
I was going to give a softer no. I was going to say basically.
I went out there.
I was going to basically say only if he has to. I mean, if kind of like the polls start changing a lot, or, you know, someone comes in with a huge amount of money for the other side and circumstances really change, maybe he throws in a couple million dollars. But right now, there's no reason he would.
We're going to know shortly. All right. Well, up next, what are some of the other props that voters are going to be asked to decide? The remaining props on the November ballot in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Mattie Institute. We're talking to Laurel Rosenhall with Cal Matters and John Myers of the LA Times. So, John, Prop 5 would amend the state constitution to give older and severely disabled homeowners a tax break. Do you think it is going to have any effect on the split roll proposal that's likely to appear in the 2020 ballot?
Well, it's certainly in that universe of how Prop 13 and property taxes work, right? I mean, we've
talked. You might want to define split roll for our audience.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you're right. It depends on how long people want to watch this, right? I mean, you go back to 1978. We know how we got Prop 13. We know the limitations it places on property tax payments. This particular measure, though, Mark, before we get to split roll, this particular measure simply extends a process that works in some counties where older Californians can effectively take their property tax rate with them when they move to a new house. Split roll, which of course is the big daddy of them all, right, is the one to change commercial property valuations policy so that you would reevaluate them earlier, you'd pay more in taxes in commercial properties versus personal. I don't know how much people will drill into that on this one. I don't know if they'll understand this one. The realtors put this one on the ballot. I just hate to say I don't know. I don't know.
What do you think, Laurel?
Well, the thing here is that the realtors have put a second measure on the 2020 ballot, which is very similar to this one that we have this November. And so basically, if this one fails, then in 2020, there will be two Prop 13 related measures on the ballot, kind of moving in different directions. So I think it impacts the calculus, the political calculus for the supporters of split roll, in that they may wind up sort of facing their enemies very directly on the ballot in 2020 with these two conflicting things. But again, that's several chess moves away.
I think the fascinating question for me is, what do the realtors want? You know, I think the realtors wanted, quite frankly, a legislative deal in Sacramento in 2018. Mm-hmm, yeah. They didn't get it. They got this on the ballot. Mm-hmm. It's there where it is. Laurel's right. They've got one teed up for 2020. They could pull that back. There's still time that they could pull that off the ballot. What do they want? Where are they involved in this mighty split roll property tax war that we are shaping up for 2020? I think it's going to be super interesting.
It's going to be a big one. You know, Prop 7 is another one we wanted to talk about, and that was the legislature would provide the legislature the ability to provide permanent daylight savings time if the federal government allows. A timely topic or a waste of time? I know, probably too clever, but...
You know...
Let me check my watch.
Yeah. Right.
The real answer on this one is that I think Brown said it in his signing message. It just allows a very circuitous path to actually making any changes. There would be numerous political and bureaucratic steps along the way.
A great signing message, by the way.
So, right, yes.
Right.
Ending
Let there
with
be
fiat lukes. Yes, exactly. So I think that this is one that is like a talker, but doesn't really have a big policy impact.
Quickly, what do you think?
It does nothing. It really does. I mean, it always sets the stage possibly for something in the future, also known as it does nothing.
Okay, so John, let's talk about, there's a bunch of other propositions on the ballot, but not as many as we've seen in the past. Does that mean some of the legislative reforms that we've seen in the past, like redistricting, longer term limits in one house, two primary system, top two primary, is it having an effect? Things are getting done in the legislature. We don't have to go to the propositions.
I don't know if I could be that rosy completely. I mean, I think that those changes in 2014 have had an impact. We've seen it in a couple of places, right? We saw it in 2016. There was a minimum wage measure that was going to be on the November ballot. The sides got together. The governor and the legislature raised the minimum wage. The system worked there. It certainly worked in 2018 when a San Francisco real estate developer came forward with this sweeping privacy measure. He got it on the ballot. The legislature moved in what? A matter of days, it was knocked off the ballot. It does work in some places, it doesn't work in others. And I give you two really quickly that are on this November ballot that show that. Prop 8, Prop 11. Prop 8 is about kidney dialysis centers. Mm-hmm. They would have loved to have had a deal on unionization of workers and wages and cost. They didn't get it, they went to the ballot. Prop 11 is about ambulance employees and rest breaks. They also wanted something in the legislature. It didn't happen, they went to the ballot. The ballot is still the court of last resort.
What do you think, Laurel?
Well, I would just point out as a side note that, you know, there's one more in addition to three that were removed because of deals in the legislature. That three initiatives that would have otherwise been on this ballot. There's one that was removed by the courts, you know, and that was the...
Splitting the state.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was kind of, you know...
Maybe next time.
Yeah, that doesn't speak to the efficacy of the legislature, but it does go to show you that there are a lot of different forces at play.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Laurel Rosenthal with Cal Matters, John Myers with the LA Times for joining us. So log on to our website at MattyInstitute.org if you want to see this and other programs. And do your part. Vote. This is Mark Kepler for the Matty Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in the Matty Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Matty Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Matty Report, visit our website at MattyInstitute.org.